This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. When you've done all you can, listened patiently, argued forcefully, cooled off, endured insults, swallowed your tongue, bargained, begged, yelled, cursed, cried, when you've tried everything, sometimes you have to walk away, even from your family. Estranged family members choose to break contact because of an ongoing negative relationship. It affects mothers and fathers.
Hello, my name is Daryl from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. I'm estranged from two of my three children. It's been about 5 years. It started with a destination wedding that I could not attend. It's been very painful.
Sisters and brothers.
Hi, this is Joe from Philly. I'm calling because I'm estranged from my brother. I have been reaching out and sending letters and texting and emailing, and I know he lives alone, and so I even sent the police to check on him. But at a certain point, it's like, you know, you're reaching out and the people aren't reaching back. Why bother?
Sons and daughters.
My name's Daniel in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm estranged from my father. He was found to be cheating on my mother for some years, and I pretty much outed him to my mom. I still love him, but he won't take responsibility for his own indiscretions.
And it's more common than you might think. How and why do family ties get severed? What does it take to reconnect those ties? And when is walking away for good the right choice? That's just ahead on 1A. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Withings, creator of the Wi-Fi Smart Scale. Meet your goals with a smart scale that delivers weight, BMI, and body composition, even a local weather report. See why Tom's Guide named Withings Body Plus the best overall smart scale of 2018. Visit withings.com/NPR for 30% off any body composition scale. Withings, giving people the tools they need to improve their lives.
Human behavior doesn't always make a ton of sense, at least on the surface.
I said, would you mind if I give the dogs a little piece of cracker with some hot sauce on it and without and see what they choose?
Hidden Brain, a spicy podcast about science, psychology, and why people do what they do.
Later this hour, writer Tara Westover will share her story of estrangement from survivalist parents in the mountains of Idaho. But first, joining us from WAER Public Radio in Syracuse is journalist Harriet Brown. Her new book is called Shadow Daughter, a memoir of estrangement. Harriet, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us from KUOW Public Radio in Seattle is Christina Sharp, an assistant professor at the University of Washington, where she studies family estrangement. Christina, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And in San Francisco, Dr. Joshua Coleman is a clinical psychologist that works with estranged families. He is the author of When Parents Hurt, Compassionate Strategies When You and Your Grown Child Don't Get Along. Dr. Coleman, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Harriet Brown, let me start with you. Your memoir documents your relationship with your mother, which eventually led to estrangement. What was the final straw for you? Why did you eventually decide that her presence was more harmful than helpful?
Well, I think like most people who make that decision, there was a moment, a sort of last straw moment, as Dr. Sharp has described it in her research, but it's really the accumulation of years and years and years of things. But for me, there was that moment, and it was during a time when my daughter had relapsed with anorexia. You know, it was a very stressful time. We were worried about whether she would survive. My mother reached out and said, you know, how can I be helpful? How can I support you? I gave her a task to do, looking up some new recipes, you know, something that really wasn't essential. But I heard her saying she wanted to be involved, and I thought, okay, maybe this is a chance for us to mend things. And then instead of getting any kind of help from her, I got a blistering email saying, basically, it's all your fault that your daughter is sick, and, you know, this is because of the work that you've done in the world, and, you know, you're lucky that I'm willing to say these things to you. Most people are too afraid of you to say these things. And I was sitting at my computer reading this, and I literally heard a crack and thought, wow, I'm having a stroke or something.
Wait, a crack? You heard a crack?
I felt like I heard a crack, you know, but I think it was a metaphor in my ear because nothing was broken except our relationship. And it was like when I blinked and recovered from that, I was done with her. I didn't want to have a relationship with her anymore. All the years of trying and trying and trying, all the angst, I suddenly felt very calm and was like, nope, that's it. That's the end.
Why would she write something like that to you at a moment when your daughter was in crisis?
That is a very good question, and I have no answer for it except to say that she took it as an opportunity to unload her own opinions on me. It was never about me, and I think that she was probably not capable of real empathy and support. I think she couldn't help herself. I mean, that was a pattern that happened with us over and over again. But, you know, I gave up trying to figure out why. It just is what it is.
What form, Harriet, did your estrangement take? Did you tell her, I don't ever want to hear from you again? Did you just stop returning her calls and emails? How did that go?
I told her I was done. That was it. And then I never talked to her again. And she didn't seem surprised, you know, judging from things I heard from my sister and other family members. I think for both of us, it felt final in some way.
What made you decide, Harriet, to tell the story of your estrangement from your mother? She's passed on, as I understand it. Is that right?
Yeah, she died 6 years ago, 7 years ago. I knew this was a story I was going to need to tell. And whenever I would talk to people about it, you know, long before when we were struggling with our difficult relationship, I was always surprised by how many people were in the same boat and how none of us were talking about it. There's a lot of shame and stigma that comes from having a bad relationship with a parent especially or being estranged from them. And so we don't talk about it. We hide it. And we all sort of suffer in silence thinking there's something really wrong with us. So I really wanted to make it clear that this is pretty common. That sometimes, you know, people need to stop pushing us to reconcile with family. Sometimes walking away is really the best thing to do.
Christina Sharp, with regards to people being in the same boat, maybe you could jump in on that note. I mean, how common is estrangement with regards to your research? What does it show in terms of how many people in this country are in the same boat?
So we don't have national data on this, unfortunately. But a variety of studies have estimated about 12% of mothers, and research would suggest that even more fathers report being estranged from at least one of their children. There's a nonprofit organization in the UK that did a survey in the UK that it was about 20-25%. So it's fairly common.
Dr. Coleman, define estrangement. Can we set some parameters around what we're talking about? Are we just talking about people who may or may not call at Christmas and Easter, or people who have just said, don't talk to me, leave me alone, I'm blocking your number, you know, unfriend me on Facebook? Or are we talking about people who've, like, taken out restraining orders on abusive loved ones? I mean, like, what? Give us some parameters. What do we mean when we say estrangement?
Well, I think typically what we mean is an actual cutoff, an actual ending of the relationship. And from my clinical research, there's a common kind of a mythology in our culture that people only end relationships with parents in particular if they've been abused by that parent. And I would want to clarify that based on the large population of both estranged adult children that I have in my practice and estranged parents and the families who are working towards reconciliation, that there's actually multiple pathways to estrangement. A common thing in the background of many estranged parents is a prior divorce. Another common cause might be a motivated son-in-law or daughter-in-law who basically tells their partner, choose your parents or me, you can't have both. It could be the mental illness on the part of the child. We talk a lot about abusive parents, but some adult children are also very difficult and abusive of the parent and may also estrange the parent as a result of that. The child's therapist therapist may be a stimulus to the estrangement when the child, adult child, gets into therapy and starts talking about their experiences, and the therapist makes a wrong inference that there was abuse in the child's past or there was some other kind of repressed memory or some other allegation of poor parenting or problematic parenting or traumatizing parenting. And that can also cause an estrangement. And finally, in one of the less talked about causes of estrangement actually comes from the ways that families are much more enmeshed today. Mm-hmm. That one of the things that's happened in the past 20 to 30 years is that because parents are so worried and so over-involved and so guilt-ridden and terrified of the world that faces their children, we become much more enmeshed with our children. We have smaller family sizes. There's much more play has moved inside. And so for some adult children, the only way they know how to feel separate from parents, often very good, loving, dedicated parents, is to completely cut off contact with them.
Melisma tweeted, "Just because you're born into a family does not give said family an unconditional right to a relationship with you if there is not mutual respect." I know we have to pause in a moment, but Harriet, that kind of sounds like the moral to your whole story in a way.
That's right. You know, the secret to my relationship with my mother could have been solved with just some respect. And, you know, that just never, ever, ever happened. She could not sustain that.
What would that respect have looked like?
It would have looked like acknowledging that we were different people and that, you know, I was an okay person and she was an okay person, even though we didn't agree about everything. Honestly, it was that basic with my mother.
Quite a few have already shared your stories of estrangement with us. Here's one more that landed in our inbox.
Hi, this is Emily from Salt Lake City responding to your question regarding estrangement with a family member. About 4 years ago, my brother graduated high school early and moved out to Utah to live with me. I was freshly 21, making 21-year-old related decisions, and we both got mixed up in things that we shouldn't have been. Ultimately, it meant the end of our relationship and the end of him considering me his sister. Losing him has been the most devastating thing I've ever experienced. So, Michael, if you're listening, I'm sorry, and I love you. Congratulations on your engagement, and I hope to talk to you soon.
I know it takes a lot of courage to share these stories, so thank you, Emily. We appreciate all of you who shared your stories with us. Sarah tweeted, "As someone who lives this, estrangement happens after repeated intentional acts of abuse and neglect, breaking trust with those we are made to believe love us. Best gift I ever gave myself was freedom from my abusive mother. My work is on the power of non-familial relationships." Bryce tweeted, "I have no contact with most of my family because I no longer believe in Jehovah's Witness ideology, and the leadership instructs members to shun us so-called apostates." Christina, we have another voice you want to add, but I wonder if you could react to that a bit in terms of whose decision it is to estrange. How often do you find that estrangement is mutual as opposed to unilateral?
So in my research, I found that it's more likely where one person is seeking distance as opposed to it being mutual, but it certainly could happen both ways. Research would suggest that it's more often the child who's seeking distance with the parent.
Before we bring in our next guest, let me get to one more voicemail that landed in our inbox.
This is Mariah from Cincinnati. I've had a very difficult relationship with my father and his side of the family. I have an upcoming wedding, and that's been causing a lot of stress trying to figure out how to navigate some of the traditional father-daughter dances and things like that.
Yeah, Mariah, thanks for sharing your story. Dr. Coleman, it's interesting how estrangement can kind of affect families more than just in an incident. It's something that even if you've cut off contact, it can be hard to get away from sometimes.
That's very true. And I wanted to address one of the earlier callers' issue of that she had cut off her family because of there was abuse and that kind of thing. One of the things that's confusing for so many of the parents that I work with is what gets called abuse today would in their generation not have been considered abuse. And this is part of what Haslin refers to as this concept creep of what we're now considering abusive, harmful, traumatizing behavior is causing many adult children, rightly or wrongly, to allege abuse for things that in earlier generations would rightly or wrongly not be considered abuse. I think it's, from my perspective as a psychologist, it's actually problematic how much we've expanded the notion of what's considered harmful or abusive behavior, because much of what I hear get talked about as being abusive, I would not consider abuse as a psychologist. But you're absolutely right that when there is a family conflict, that it ricochets out into the larger family as a whole, that many of the adult children who are cutting off contact with their parents, they're also ending the relationship with that parent's grandchildren, and that has implications for the whole family as well.
Dr. Coleman, can you give an example of one of those behaviors that has kind of shifted over the years in terms of whether it's construed as abuse?
Yeah, I would say it's what as psychologists we would refer to as emotional attunement, that something or something that might have been considered controlling or manipulative or even hurtful, critical comments. Those, I would not consider those abusive behavior. But part of the problem is that we live in a culture that's very much dominated by a kind of a psychological narrative where people are led to believe that the way that their lives turned out are almost exclusively or dominated by their childhoods. And in fact, the research doesn't really show that to be the case, that in fact, many of the ways that we turn out have much more to do with genetics, with social class, with economics. So we live in a society and at a time where parents are, so much is being put onto parents' shoulders that other cultures have the wisdom not to. Other cultures in Western industrialized nations have free or highly subsidized childcare. They have free or highly subsidized college. They have free or highly subsidized insurance. And in America, this is all put on the backs of the parents. Mm-hmm. There's a reason that today's parents are deeply worried and over-involved and concerned about their children's safety, because it's all on them.
I just want to make sure we're clear, Dr. Coleman, before we bring in our next guest. It sounds like you're not saying that harsh language or harsh comments are never abusive, but that they're not always inherently abusive. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
Gotcha.
I think that if you look at the average home, there's going to be times when all parents say things which are hurtful or strong, or they lose their tempers,
or they say
things that they regret. But no, there is a real thing that's abusive and traumatizing. I'm not saying it never occurs.
Right.
I just think that the concept has been so greatly expanded that it's becoming more of a problem than an asset.
Let me add one more voice to our conversation as we continue with psychologist Joshua Coleman, Christina Sharp of the University of Washington, and author Harriet Brown. Joining us from NPR in New York is Tara Westover, the author of Educated, a memoir. Tara, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, in your book, you write about growing up in the mountains of Idaho with a family of survivalists. They rejected things like formal education or modern medicine. You are estranged from them now. What was your last straw? Was it the point at which you became aware that this was out of the norm, or was there something else?
I didn't really have a last straw. I think for me, the process of estrangement was very much a process. There wasn't really a moment. My family was, they were extreme. They didn't believe in a lot of things most people believe in, which is why I never went to school or to the doctor. I didn't have a birth certificate. But that, even as I moved in and became more mainstream and went to university, it was difficult to navigate, but it was, I would say, possible to navigate. But ultimately, my parents and I had an older brother who, from the time I was young, had been very violent towards me. He'd been violent towards other people. And I confronted my parents about it wisely, or it turned out kind of unwisely. And I think initially they just resisted the narrative, but really quickly I think they felt the need to try to kind of keep me from talking about that, because I think they were very afraid of what it would mean to talk about it. And So initially, when we became estranged, it was their decision. I was ostracized from my family. It was not my choice. And I was beyond desperate to get back in. I think I would have done just about anything to get back in. And for me, there was a probably 3 or 4 year period of trying to overturn the narrative that my parents had developed about me, which went pretty far. There was a time where they were telling people I was possessed as a way to explain why I said, well, you know, they're kind of extreme people. They had a really extreme ideology. So anything that came in would somehow be made sense of through that.
Is that connected to them being survivalists, Tara? Is that related to their religious beliefs, their ideology?
You know, it's a complicated question. My parents were Mormon, but they weren't representative of Mormonism. Everyone else in our town went to school. They went to the doctor. I think my dad, I've speculated that he had something like bipolar disorder or something like schizophrenia that made him excessively paranoid, really, really to a degree that I don't think you can explain by the religion. I think the religion was a vehicle for it. So he would be confronted with a problem like his daughter saying something like I was saying, and just one way that he would understand it is, well, she must be possessed.
You told us about a moment when you felt like you had to choose between yourself and your parents. What was that like?
Well, it was, you know, I was a fellow at Harvard, and I hadn't seen my parents in a year or two, and they came to visit me. And it was during this time where they believed I was possessed. They were telling people I was possessed as a way to explain what I had said about my brother. And my father came to me. He visited me at Harvard. They stayed with me for a week. And at the end of this time, my father offered me a kind of blessing, which in his mind, I think, was a sort of exorcism that he could cast out this demon and then it would be me again. It would be his daughter and I would be healed. And I think, aside from just the bizarreness of it, it was a moment where I felt like I had a specific view of what had happened to me, of what needed to happen in my family going forward for us to heal, which was to get my brother some help. And that's what I thought. And I was being given an opportunity to effectively just recant that. And if I could just go through this blessing, this exorcism, I could say, well, I never meant any of the things I said, and that was just that evil possession, and I could just take it all back. And because I'd been working for a couple of years at that point to effectively try to take it back, I came, I think, fairly close to just taking that route. And I think it was a really clear moment where what I was being asked to choose between really was myself and my family. I could be myself, or I could be the daughter that they wanted. And yeah. I think eventually I've kind of figured out, you know, what my dad was trying to cast out of me that day. It wasn't a demon. It was me. Like, I said those things. I'm the one that thought those things about my brother. It wasn't some possessing spirit. That was me.
Harriet Brown, I'd love to bring you back into the conversation and just to get your reactions to what we're hearing from Tara. Granted, it's a fairly, you know, unconventional story, but do you feel any common bonds or hear any similarities between what you went through and what Tara described?
Oh, absolutely. That notion that this is something you have to do to be yourself, to save yourself, to preserve yourself in the sense of who you are as opposed to who these other people want you to be. That was very much my story, too. You know, my family wanted me to be something very conventional, nothing like what Tara's describing, but it wasn't so much about the fact that I wanted to be a writer versus a lawyer, which is what they wanted for me. It was more about the autonomy to have your own opinions, your own take on things, your own perspective. You know, to live in my family's world, they didn't belong to a cult, but they kind of were the cult of my mother, you know. And in order to live in that world, everyone had to agree with her all the time and had to see things the way she did. And if you didn't, you just simply weren't allowed to. So it was very similar sense for me of, if I'm going to save myself, the person that I am and who I like the person I am, that's part of it. And, you know, I talked to 50 other people who've been through this, and I heard some version of that from almost every single one of them. You know, earlier in the program, Dr. Coleman sort of suggested that sometimes adult children just walk away because they're too close and they don't know how to separate, or for reasons that are perhaps not all that significant. And I just want to say that's not true for anyone I have spoken to, and it certainly wasn't true for me, that, you know, those of us who have been through this, like Tara said, you know, you want to be part of this family. So many things make you want to belong to this family and want to go along with it, that the decision to walk away is huge, and it requires a lot of fortitude to do that.
Before I let Dr. Coleman respond, and I would like you to jump back in, this sounds connected to another message that a listener left in our inbox.
My name is Melissa. I'm calling from Colorado. I have been estranged from my parents as well as my sister for 10 years. And although my father was an officer in the military, we grew up in a household full of emotional and physical abuse. When I turned 21 and had just graduated from college, I was both physically and verbally attacked by my parents. I left home that day with a black eye and a promise to myself that the abusive cycle that had gone on in my family for generations stopped with me. I have grown up with a lot of shame from both our family, friends, and outsiders who just simply can't understand why I would turn my back on my abusive parents. Over the years, I have decided that instead of carrying that shame, to put the shame where it belongs, and that's with my abusive family.
Melissa, thanks for sharing your story with us. Dr. Coleman, I wonder if you are hearing that common bond in terms of dealing with shame, of separation from family, saving oneself. Both the stories that Tara and Harriet told feel like they have to do with choosing whether you're just going to be kind of a reflection of your family or be your own person.
Well, certainly, and the experiences of both Tara and Harriet are very poignant, and it's easy for me or anybody else to empathize with that, and certainly anybody else who's been through lived in a family that was abusive. But I want to clarify that that is not the sum total of people who are estranging themselves. People are not estranging themselves purely or only for reasons because they have toxic, abusive parents. And I think this is a big problem in our culture. There are many loving, decent parents who've been very dedicated, who are also being estranged by their adult children. And to clarify my point, Harriet, about enmeshment. Enmeshment's actually a serious psychological struggle. I'm not at all suggesting that if somebody cuts off a parent because they feel overly enmeshed with him, that somehow that means that it's not it's a simple or something that they consider in a trifling way. It's really a desperate attempt to hold on to feelings of themselves because they feel too weighed down by the parents' feelings. And I think that's more a function of the way that parenting has changed in the past few decades, that because parents have become so worried and so involved and so, you know, helicoptering is really the new normal, that for a certain percentage of adult children, the only way they know to get their parents out of their heads and their hearts and their minds is to separate from them.
Yeah.
And it's not because the parents were so toxic, as much as they may tell their therapist that, or that may be the common narrative.
Let me get to a few more of your stories now. Sabrina emailed, "My 30-year-old daughter estranged me, her mother, and stepdad 3 years ago. We did not have an argument. To this day, I do not understand why she cut off ties with us. Her 31st birthday is this weekend, and I hurt every day." Barb tweeted, "Our 29-year-old son has estranged himself from our family. He got married in October. Me, my husband, and our 32-year-old daughter, who lives with us, attended the wedding. It was a humiliating experience. We weren't recognized, and our son wouldn't talk to us. Nothing since." Catherine emailed, "After 7 years of silence, my sister reached out to us. My heart is full. Point being, even in the worst of times, relationships can be healed. Be patient and keep your heart and arms open without sacrificing your own well-being." Thank you for sharing that with us, Catherine. We want to talk about what it takes to heal estrangement, when indeed it can and is appropriate to heal. Stay close.
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Cardiff Garcia, and we are the hosts of The Indicator from Planet Money,
your quick daily podcast that will help you understand economic ideas.
Like my favorite, the yield curve.
The yield curve.
You love it.
I'm learning to love it.
Back now to our conversation with Dr. Joshua Coleman, researcher Christina Sharp, author Tara Westover, the author of Educated, and Harriet Brown, the author of Shadow Daughter, a memoir of family estrangement. Christina, let's talk a bit about reconciliation. A lot of pop culture kind of would lead us to believe that reconciling is the best way to go in general. I don't know if there are any other Indiana Jones fans out there, but if you've seen The Last Crusade, you might remember this scene between Indiana Jones, played by Harrison Ford, and his father, played by Sean Connery.
Did I ever tell you to eat up, go to bed, wash your ears, do your homework? No, I respected your privacy, and I taught you self-reliance.
What you taught me was that I was less important to you than people who'd been dead for 500 years in another country. And I learned it so well that we've hardly spoken for 20 years.
You left just when you were becoming interesting.
Dad, how
can you? I'm here now.
Sean Connery and Harrison Ford in Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. Christina, setting pop culture aside, is reconciliation generally best? And for that matter, what does best even mean?
Sure. So I think this goes back to the conversation we're having even before about why estrangement happens. So I absolutely respect Dr. Coleman and his assessment about objective interactions with abuse. But all the people who I talk to, like, it has been truly their experience that they're being abused, whether that is psychologically, physically, sexually, or as a result of substance abuse or mental health issues. And so for the people who I've talked to, estrangement was really a healthy solution for an unhealthy environment. And so in cases where people are experiencing this, you know, extensive abuse, I'm not sure that reconciliation is always the best course of action, especially when people's safeties, their safety is on the line, such as some of the callers who we've heard from today.
We've heard from several of you regarding this tension between estrangement and reconciliation. Ayamita tweeted, "I am estranged from my father, who has struggled with alcoholism my entire life. I intend to reconnect with him in the near future, but am currently focusing on tending to my mental health and personal well-being. I don't feel capable of taking care of him, too. Not right now." Jean tweeted, "My white parents cut me out of their lives when I married an African American. Of my three best friends, all of us have had someone estranged. So yes, it's common and difficult to be bombarded with the family overall cultural narrative." Harriet, I wonder if you could respond to another tweet kind of about that narrative. Wesley writes, "What people often don't realize about estrangement, I broke off contact with my mother for numerous reasons over a decade ago, is that other people don't think you are a good person because you don't speak with your family regardless of your reasons." Harriet, does that resonate for you?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's why many people don't tell other people. A lot of the people I spoke to for this book said, "I don't have any close friends because every time I try to get close to someone and they find out I'm not in touch with my family, they inevitably think, well, what's wrong with you? Why are you, you know, why have you made such a radical decision?" So I think that that's very, very much, there's so much shame and stigma. And to me, and in my experience, that supports the idea that people don't walk away casually and they don't walk away, you know, out of a sense of aggrievedness. It's such a huge decision. And I know that Dr. Sharp in her research talks about this long period of chaotic dissociation that people go through, just basically meaning, you know, you keep trying to reconcile, something happens, you fall apart, you come back together, fall apart. And that's how it goes, because we want to be part of this family unit, but for some of us, it's simply not possible.
Tara, what about you?
I think I agree. I don't think people walk away from estrangement lightly. I just think there's such a strong desire to be close to your family, and probably even stronger in some dysfunctional families. That's the way I experienced it. I did not think it was an easy thing to do. I would say, as far as what other people think, she's right, and there is an incredible stigma about it, but I think I struggled more with my own opinion of myself than with other people's opinions of me. I remember going through this period when my parents first started to have these really extreme views of me and coming up with these explanations for why I'd said what I'd said, that it was, I just would think to myself, like, how do I believe that I am a good person when I know that my mother doesn't think I'm a good person? And it just felt like this was the one person that is supposed to always think the best of you, and when they think the absolute worst of you. I found it a lot harder to explain to myself why she was wrong. And actually for me, and I don't know if this would be true for everyone, but I found once I had solved that problem, that I myself didn't actually trust myself because I had become estranged from my parents, once I believed myself that it was the right decision and that I had reasons to do it, and I absolved myself of all the, or maybe even just some of the guilt, I worried a lot less what people thought of me, because what they thought of me wasn't confirming something that I believed about myself.
Teresa sent us an email, and Dr. Coleman, this cuts at the heart of one of the saddest realities that personally I've had to confront as the host of this program for the last 2 years. Teresa emailed, "I'm surprised that you have not mentioned politics, especially since our last presidential election. I have a sister with whom I used to enjoy intelligent conversation several times a week. She avidly supports Trump, and I now question her intelligence, and we rarely talk anymore. I no longer respect her." Dr. Coleman, I think one of the most heartbreaking things about the run-up to this program is how many people reported not going home for Thanksgiving or for Christmas after the 2016 election, that it just instantly severed families because of one vote. A big vote, yeah, but that it was just so, it was like a white hot sword that just cut the nation in half.
It's true. I've worked with some of those families in my practice where it's become a huge dividing line. And I think it's not just the election. I think it's the increasingly tribal nature of family life, and that this happens in the generations as well. If you look in the forums of the estranged adult children versus the forums of the parent, you see this ongoing kind of war of ideas and feelings. But to get back to the notion of healing, I actually think that parents do have to take responsibility. And in terms of healing from a reconciliation, my methodology is that parents have to show deep empathy for their adult child, that they have to be, if the child feels that they were abused, even if that's at odds with the parent's reckoning, that the parent has to get inside the heart and mind of the child and see why they feel that way, to not challenge it, to not be defensive about it, to not explain it, to show commitment, to make amends. So I think this generational divide, though, that we're hearing somewhat reflected in this interview, can be healed. And I think that parents do have to take the lead, A, because the buck stops with them, but B, also because nothing compels adult children to have a relationship with their parents today beyond whether or not that adult child wants it. So from that perspective, it is incumbent on parents to take the lead in that.
Christina, I wonder if it becomes harder when we talk about things that are ideological, like politics, or like what Gretchen suggested. Gretchen tweeted, "Please talk about LGBTQ children and adults being thrown out of families. I was very blessed that I have a family that is mostly very, very, very accepting of me being gay. There are one or two relatives in particular who are just kind of like, I love you, but." And that feels like it creates a friction point that becomes intractable. You know, God said that this thing that you are or do or like is bad, and I'm not going to countermand God even though I love you. Like, that just feels... that feels completely intractable in many cases.
So it's certainly difficult. And I want to recognize how difficult it is for everyone going through it. And I would say that from the people who I talk with the most, which is the adult children, depending on why they feel they want a distance from their family, often dictates how they feel about reconciliation. Some people say, I never want to reconcile. But others, especially around some ideological differences, have some stronger caveats. If we were able to talk about this in a respectful way, if whatever they need to have happened, are a little bit open to if things could change, we could have a relationship. And I also like to think of estrangement as a continuum, that you're either more or less estranged as opposed to estranged or not estranged, because estrangement can look very different. And so I think some of the reasons why people want to distance in the first place often might dictate the possibilities around reconciliation.
Beth commented on our Facebook page, "Other than a nodding hello at family functions, my brother and I no longer speak. I became ill with Lyme disease in 2012, and from the very start, he questioned the diagnosis, choice of doctor, treatment protocol, everything. We even tried a half dozen therapy sessions together, but it was a disaster. Because of this, I don't believe the relationship can ever be repaired." We heard from several of you who shared why estrangement was the right choice for you, that you are comfortable and resolute in the choice that you made. Here are two messages that we mashed together that landed in our inbox.
Hi, this is Liz from Grand Rapids, Minnesota.
This is Judy calling from Arizona.
I grew up with a biological father I was terrified of. He physically abused my mother for decades.
I became estranged from my father in 2005. After he told me he hoped I died and burned in hell.
The day I realized salvaging our relationship was out of my control was when he told me he and his wife and their friends had been betting on how many days I'd be able to stay at my new job. I realized being in contact with him was toxic, and I had to do what was healthy for me.
A friend of mine said to me that if my husband had spoken to me that way, I would have divorced him. That statement allowed me to separate myself completely from this very difficult man. The estrangement has not been easy, but it has been liberating.
Judy, Liz, thank you both very much for sharing your stories with us. Let's spend a moment before our time is up talking a bit about reconciliation. I wonder, Tara and Harriet, if there are any circumstances under which you would consider trying to reconcile with your family. If not, that's fine. But Tara, are there any circumstances under which you would consider reconciliation?
Yeah, there are. I think, you know, for me, it turned on this fact of my brother, and that I felt like he needed to get help so that situation could be made safe. And my parents couldn't really accept that. So that's where the fracture really came from. And I think, were that to change, were they to become capable of at least talking about it? I don't even know if I would need them to fully believe me and take me seriously, but at least to talk about it without going to possession. I think I could really happily reconcile. But I guess where I've got to with it is, I don't feel like I need my family to change in order for me to love them, but I do feel like I need them to change if I'm going to have them in my life. And one of the things that it took me a long time to really come to understand is I just don't have any control over what other people do and who they are. And for me, becoming estranged, actually, as weird as it is to say, was kind of the best way to just accept them for who they are and stop trying to change them, stop having all this conflict where I was trying to make them into someone that they just weren't. And it was kind of the only way that I could just say, you know, you're okay the way you are, and I get to make you decide what you're going to do, and I'm going to decide what I do. And that's really all anyone can do.
Harriet, what about you?
Yes, well, I actually did reconcile with my father after my mother died. It took us a year or two. And the reason that we were able to reconcile is because we were able to actually speak honestly with each other, hear each other. I think we have very different perspectives on my mother, even to this day. We don't agree on the narrative of what happened, but I think that we showed each other that we have enough respect and love for the other person that, you know, I'm happy to have him in my life now. In fact, he moved to my town and is in an assisted living place 5 minutes from my house, and I see him all the time. So I think that, you know, as Tara said, you can accept that someone doesn't agree with you, sees things differently from you, but if there's that mutual respect, that's kind of a big part of what you need to reconcile.
Very briefly, before we have to wrap, Christina, for people who are dealing with estrangement, any one big thing you want them to keep in mind as they kind of struggle with this, briefly?
I would say that we have a lot of narratives in our culture that would suggest that we can choose our friends, but we can't choose our family. But I would say, why can't we choose our family? A family could be someone who acts like a family, who has the affection that we feel towards family. And we don't always have to have blood ties.
Yeah.
We might even have these voluntary kin if we do have blood ties. But it's important to surround ourselves with people who can support us and help us feel like we're a part of something.
Christina Sharp, an assistant professor at the University of Washington, where she runs the Family Communication and Relationships Lab. Christina, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Tara Westover, the author of Educated, a memoir. Thank you, Tara.
Thanks.
Harriet Brown, the author of Shadow Daughter, a memoir of family estrangement. Harriet, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And clinical psychologist Dr. Joshua Coleman. His book is called When Parents Hurt, Compassionate Strategies When You and Your Grown Child Don't Get Along. Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks for having me.
Today's conversation was produced by Avery Kleinman. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.